Tonight on Canton Confidential, the Karen Reed murder trial. Tense moments inside the courtroom while outside. A trip beyond the buffer zone to the scene of the alleged crime.
Between that report that you gave to Trooper Proctor, that statement that you gave to Trooper Proctor, and yesterday's testimony, your statement has evolved.
I've always testified to I feel as though my testimony has been consistent.
Good evening, I'm J.C. Monahan. Glenn Jones has the night off. The first week of testimony has come to an end, and today several first responders took the stand. The jury stepped outside the courtroom. Jurors visited two sites in Canton, one of the bars where John O'Keefe and Karen Reed were that night, and the front yard where eventually John O'Keefe was found. The jury also got a close-up look at the vehicle that we know is similar to the one prosecutors say Reed was driving when she allegedly hit her Boston police officer boyfriend. We do have team coverage this evening, taking you both inside and outside the Dedham courthouse. We want to begin with NBC 10's Eli Rosenberg. He's going to give us a closer look at the jury's visit to Canton. Eli.
JC, it's been a busy week. We've had opening statements and a lot of testimony and a lot of focus on this house in Canton, 34 Fairview Road. In a black SUV, prosecutors say Karen Reed was driving. Today, jurors got to see both firsthand. And like so much during this case and trial, this attracted a lot of attention.
Karen, how do you think the view went for the jury?
Well,
Karen Reed leaving court on Friday evening, hours after the jury in her criminal trial made their first site visit under heavy security.
It's a spectacle, that's for sure.
Jurors spending about an hour outside 34 Fairview Road in Canton. It was outside here that prosecutors say Boston police officer John O'Keefe's body was found in late January 2022.
I'm a little uneasy coming down.
Marnie Salkovitz was watching the trial Friday morning, heard about the site visit, and raced over from Brookline.
The scene in person is kind of crazy, yeah. The whole thing.
Also outside the home on Friday, this black Lexus SUV. Prosecutors allege Reed was driving a black SUV when she hit O'Keefe and left him for dead. And while it isn't clear if this is the same SUV, as you can see, this one is also missing a back passenger taillight.
Saw the jurors kind of meandering around. They had some sticks. I don't know what that was all about.
Sometimes it's more, it's not as easy to understand what the actual layout looks like unless you actually visit the scene. In this way, it gives a little bit more context and perspective.
Attorney Catherine Loftus has been tracking the retrial on TikTok and says site visits like what we saw on Friday really help jurors put into context what they're hearing and seeing in court.
I think anybody knows that a picture is never quite the same as what it looks like in real life. So for the jury to go to the actual scene, to be able to look at everything, it's always preferable to do it that way.
Now, Eli, the judge gave a lot of restrictions before today's site visit. It's called a view. Can you walk us through what was and was not allowed, not just by the jury, but by the media as well?
Yeah, JC, there was actually a court order in place over all of this, and it said that members of the media, members of the public had to be kept back 100 yards. You saw the state police there taking charge of that. Also, while they were out there, jurors not allowed to take any notes or photos. And right now, JC, it is not clear if this will be the only site visit of this trial. JC.
All right, Eli, we know you'll follow it for us. Thank you. Back inside the Dedham courthouse, it was another day of detailed testimony from several first responders. And once again on cross, the defense questioned the first responder's memory of that morning. And a graphic photo was shown of some of John O'Keefe's injuries. NBC 10's John Maroney breaks down the important moments.
Respectfully, I think my testimony has been pretty consistent.
Canton firefighter Caden McLaughlin defending her recollection after John O'Keefe's body was found on the snowy front lawn of a Canton home. She told jurors Thursday that she heard Karen Reed say, "I hit him." Under cross-examination, she acknowledged she's added details to her initial story.
I understand what you're saying.
So has your story evolved?
Okay, yes.
The defense suggested McLaughlin's testimony is biased altogether, given her friendship with Caitlin Albert. Her parents own the home where O'Keefe's body was found, and Reed's lawyers have said her father, Brian, conspired with others to blame their client. McLaughlin said she doesn't know the younger Albert very well.
We're not close friends. I would say we're more acquaintances. We have mutual friends. I don't have a one-on-one relationship with her.
The observations that you make while on The View may be used and considered in your deliberations in reaching a verdict.
After 4 days of testimony, the jury was given a firsthand look at 34 Fairview Road in Canton, the crime scene where John O'Keefe's body was found.
There was also going to be a vehicle there as well, and I'm going to ask you to take note of certain things with respect to that vehicle.
They believe you're a threat to yourself or others.
The week's proceedings ended Friday with more first responders. The jury was shown a picture of big scratches on John O'Keefe's arm. Plus, they learned how Reed was eventually taken to the hospital.
Because she made threats against her life, saying, I don't want to live anymore. If my husband dies, I don't want to be alive anymore.
The jurors have gone home for the day. They will be back on Monday for the start of the second week of testimony. In Dedham, John Maroney, NBC 10 Boston.
And now our trial insider, Sue O'Connell, is joining us. Sue, the prosecution gave the jury a lot to think about as they head into the weekend. Can you talk about the testimony from the paramedic, Katie McLaughlin? Because that's what seemed to really get the prosecution a little heated. I mean, the defense a little heated.
Yeah, but also it got the prosecution a little heated. It was kind of the first time we saw something happening in the trial that wasn't sort of predictable. I mean, we're talking about the reports of the detail that Katie McLaughlin was giving. But the real back and forth was around Alan Jackson's questioning of her relationship with Caitlin Alpert. Her family owned the home where John O'Keefe was found. And it was a little striking because Alan Jackson, I think, is a very good lawyer, but he seemed a little tone deaf. We're going to talk later in the show about introducing the evidence of photos. But after that was resolved, it seemed he was confused that teenage girls 10 years ago might have thousands of pictures on their phone, and that you and I might be in a friend group if we're in high school, mm-hmm. but we may not even like each other. We may be forced to be together all the time. That doesn't mean that we have a friendship. So McLaughlin really pushed back on this description of her being friends with Caitlin Albert, but more that they were just acquaintances who were in a big friend group. And she didn't say they were in thousands of pictures together, but that's just my inference.
No, the point was, here she is, a paramedic on the scene treating John O'Keefe, and the defense was basically saying, but you have a reason for a conspiracy in this because you knew this Caitlin Albert back in high school. And
right.
And I get it. You don't always remember every photo that's taken of you, but we heard a lot of the same thing, like, how could you not remember someone you went to high school
right.
with? This is the first time we heard about Karen Reed's medical history.
Yes.
It's the first time. I was wondering when this was going to come in. Why were paramedics sent back to the scene? So John O'Keefe has been brought to the hospital, mm-hmm. and the paramedics are on the way home, and they get called back to the site for what's called a Section 12. Can
yes.
you talk about that?
Yeah, Section 12 is when someone is involuntarily put in a hospital due to mental health issues. The paramedics say that she threatened to kill herself or self-harm. She was incredibly distraught by all reports. She did go back and forth a little bit with her mood, but they felt that she was a danger to herself, and so they wanted to hospitalize her. And again, this is one of those things. No matter who you think did this or what you think happened, being distraught at the scene of finding the body of your boyfriend mm-hmm. and then having to interact with police on the snowy morning, as we know it was snowy, it definitely would make one upset. So I'm not sure where that goes for the prosecution or the defense, but it did give the defense an opportunity to introduce the jury that Karen has MS. And I imagine that we might hear more about that as the trial goes on.
That was brand new. But even the paramedic said her demeanor was what you would expect, one would expect in a situation like you just described, but then got into her response in the hospital, which came across very angry, wouldn't get into the Johnny, yelling, I think, nurses, or
yeah.
there was some interaction that basically didn't paint her in the best light.
Right, but I will tell you, as someone who has tried to section someone, it's not like they go voluntarily. That's why it's done involuntarily.
Right.
So when you have someone who's in mental distress and you're trying to hospitalize them, it's not like they say, hey, thanks for putting me in the hospital.
Right.
Yes, I'll urinate in this cup and I'll put it on this journal.
That's what it was.
My boyfriend is dead. So her behavior as reported, no matter how you think this went down, is appropriate. So we'll see where we go forward with this, with what the defense will take from it.
Just on a side note, as we wrap up, she referred to him as her husband.
Right. And I think that's because she wasn't going to be allowed back to see him unless she was next of kin. As a lesbian who was not able to marry, that happens a lot in the world. So she had the
presence
of mind to do that, but you know, we don't know where that falls in that.
So. Well, we'll see where the testimony goes from here. So you'll be back in the next half hour, so don't go anywhere. We'll hear more from her. But first, the role social media has played in this very high-profile case. Stay with us. You're watching Canton Confidential, the Karen Reed murder trial. Welcome back. Joining me now is David Richard. He's CEO of Big Fish PR and a professor at Emerson College. Thank you, Richard, for being with us, David, I should say. I want to talk to you about the buildup to this case. This started out with, you know, maybe a little article in the newspaper. In the years since, there has been a real interest that has peaked that now we have national attention. Can you talk about the PR, as a PR specialist, sort of how that spin happened that so many people are invested in this?
Certainly. It has all the ingredients that you're looking for in the story that just you can't look away from. And it's layered on top of what we've been seeing on digital media for years, going with Serial, the true crime series,
right,
where people can't wait for the next episode to drop. And that's what we're seeing, where, you know, each day of the trial is something that you have to tune into, and there's no spoiler alert, you can't go to the end, you have to follow it. And so the ingredients that have come together here are, you know, there's two storylines that are on each side. You know, what you would see at the sort of the end of some big true crime.
Well, people made up their minds. I mean, there are supporters out there who have been out there to the point that we have a 200-foot buffer zone around the court because they had signs, Karen Reed supporters dressed in pink, but there were also people who were supporting not just John O'Keefe's family and John O'Keefe, but the police as well. This seems to have all stemmed from social media.
Yeah. So what's happened is that you have these internet sleuths. They've dug in, they looked at the bits of the story that you could get even before the trial started, and they started doing their own digging and creating their own narratives. Mm-hmm. And now what you have is, you know, thousands upon thousands of people all, you know, looking into, you know, different angles and potential
and
motives.
And misinformation.
And so, you know, half the people believe that, you know, it's a frame up, and half the people believe that, you know, it's this, you know, murderous romance, and, you know, nobody knows really what it is because the trial is still going on. Mm-hmm. But they've all kind of chosen the narrative that they want, and they're tuning in to see how it's going to play out.
I just look back, and you can't make comparisons between trials, but I look back to O.J. Simpson, where this kind of attention came once trial started, once you started hearing the facts. This blew up in the time leading up to the trial. Given social media and what's going on, is this what we can expect from trials moving forward, at least ones that have this kind of divisive storyline?
For sure. Once it snowballs and it reaches that critical mass, that's what we're going to see. This is sort of the status quo of trials that reach that sort of limelight level that, you know, the entire country is looking at. And I really believe that this case would be on the front page of every single news story if the Trump case wasn't going on right now.
Interesting. You think that that's the only reason this isn't getting even more?
Completely. If the Trump trial was to conclude today and this was still going on, this would be on the front page of all the national news.
Well, we have 6 to 8 more weeks, they estimate, before this wraps up. So we never know where this could go from here. David Richard, thank you so much for joining me tonight and giving that perspective. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right. Well, there's so much more to talk about tonight, including something we noticed was missing inside the courtroom today. Our Sue O'Connell will be back in studio for that. Plus, we're taking your trial questions to the experts, those answers, when we come back. We are back now with two guests. We have Sue O'Connell returning and Morgietta Duraisier, an attorney with Bay State Law Group who specializes in criminal defense. Sue, I want to start with you. One of the first things you said to me when I saw you back here at NBC 10 was, what was missing in the courtroom today that you found sort of startling.
Yeah, it's a small courtroom. There's only, maybe less than 12 supporters of Karen Reed or family and friends and the O'Keefes not sitting together. And every day that I've been in the courtroom, the people behind Karen Reed have been wearing pink, which is the color that they have adopted as to show their support for Karen Reed because they can't have signs within the buffer zone. Today, none of them had pink on. One of the gentlemen might have had a shirt on that was a light lilac. I couldn't really see it clearly, but it was striking to me because yesterday or the other day it looked like an Easter parade. And
right.
Then today they were all very well dressed all along, but there was no pink whatsoever. I don't know if there was a message sent to them by the defense team that the pink is too much or that we were going to see autopsy photos today and that maybe some respect should be shown, that you don't need to really broadcast your support in that moment. But I'm sure it's all orchestrated. Yeah.
Oh, Gianna, does that ring?
Yeah, sometimes you do have to pay respect to the court. It is a formal proceeding, and you want to be respectful of that. So I didn't see that part today, but I could imagine that that's what it would be for.
Well, we've been inviting viewers to give us their questions, and we need a legal expert to answer it. It's not going to be me.
Or me.
So here is the question from Leon B. in West Roxbury. He asks, how can the prosecution make objections without any grounds for said objection? I thought objections had to be based on something. Is this a Massachusetts thing? There you can see what was sent in. That's what I just read there. Morgita, without making us learn everything about the legal system, in short, what is that about? We don't hear objection leading the witness. It's
right.
Just, I object.
So just on the basis, objections are to preserve the record, right? So whoever wins or loses, let's just put it that way, is going to appeal, right? So whoever the appeals attorney is going to look at the record, and you can only preserve what you object. Now, each judge or judges or courtrooms will have their own flavor or style where you can state your objection or not. But the judge, for the most part, what I'm seeing, understands what the objection is and is taking her stance on what that could be. Or they may go to sidebar. And sometimes you guys have seen them go to sidebar. They'll have full discussions on what the objection is.
There were a lot of sidebars
today. She seems to be also objecting before sometimes the question gets out. And today she had to direct one of the witnesses that if she says sustained, they're supposed to stop talking.
Yeah.
Which I thought was, we're a few days in here to testimony.
Well, it's
right,
like a race, right, to
yeah.
make sure, because once we talked about this the last time that we had you here, is that once the jury hears it, they can't unhear it.
Absolutely.
So, right, the objection is just get it in so that you can get them to stop talking.
And again, you just have to remember, it's the judge's job to make sure the facts come out on both sides, right? And so it's a playing field. So sometimes the judge will have to remind the witnesses, you cannot further answer or do not further answer because there is an objection that was sustained or something of that nature. So,
well, talk to me about what you thought about both of you, about the prosecution today, because we've sort of said how slow it's been leading up. And today, on this Friday, we got one fact after another that even seemed to rile up the defense attorneys a little bit. I mean, we saw Alan Jackson kind of get a little hot under the collar. What did you think?
So again, I think 6 to 8 weeks is a really long time.
Yes.
And, I said this from day one, you can't really count either side out. We saw the defense coming in real strong on the mm-hmm. first couple of days, and the prosecution may come out in the next few days. We have a long way to go.
Did you like the tactic, though, today?
I did. I really did like the tactic. I liked the directness that he was directing towards the jury. And sometimes you need that because the facts are the facts, but you have to make it relatable to whatever you're trying to prove at that time.
Did you feel a difference today?
Yeah, I definitely did. I mean, I think part of it is, and I don't mean this, people do their jobs. They're not meant to be witnesses and give testimony. But
sure.
Some of the witnesses had a little bit more gravitas today than the other witnesses did, and they had more command, I thought, of exactly what happened on the scene. It might have been because their jobs are different. Again, I'm not saying one person or the other.
No, I mean, these are just civilians coming in telling people what
exactly.
they saw and didn't see.
But it did feel like there was a little bit more gravitas, which helped the prosecution. And I think Katie McLaughlin this morning, we've talked a lot about this, she really kind of went back at Jackson.
The paramedic.
Mm-hmm. In a way that other witnesses had not, and that kind of brought the heat up in the courtroom.
You noticed also, we can't see the jury, obviously, but you made a comment when we came in today. It felt like a Friday.
Yeah, they looked tired. I don't know if I was projecting because I was tired, but it was definitely, to your point, oh my gosh, this is just 1 week, yeah, and it's Friday, and now we have to go on a site visit, and then we have to come back and hear more testimony. I mean, I'm projecting, of course, but you could just see in the body language of the jurors that there was just, they were just tired.
I can imagine. And again, Morgietta, you said it yourself, we are only in the first week.
Only the first
Pace
week.
Ourselves. Mm-hmm. All right, when the trial resumes next week, we want you to join the conversation. Thanks to Leon for sending in tonight's question for Morgietta. And if you have something you'd like to ask us, send us an email at canton.confidential@nbcuni.com. Week one of testimony is in the books. It resumes Monday morning at 9 a.m. in Dedham. And then we'll see you hopefully back here at 7 p.m. for another edition of Canton Confidential. Scan that QR code right there to get more details, a look at the timeline. Have a great weekend, everyone. We'll see you on Monday.